those, how those themes play out in their book. Kester, he is the best-selling author of That Book About Harvard, a comedic memoir about his time as an undergrad. He's also an accomplished journalist, and his latest work, Gut Check, is his first book for young readers. It's a book about a young man joining a football team, but it's not a book that you have to be a sports fan to read. Next to him is Tanha Lai.
Yes.
She is the author of the award-winning book Inside Out and Back Again, and also an accomplished journalist. Her latest book, Butterfly Yellow, is a very timely story of a young refugee from Vietnam who's searching for her brother. Next we have Nandini, I'm sorry, Bajpai. She grew up in New Delhi and has published a number of books in India, including she's the author of Red Turban, White Horse, and Rishi and the Karmic Cat. I really want to read these. Her U.S. debut is A Match Made in Mendi. It's a quirky, lovable romance story. And then finally, Tammy Charles, my tongue is getting wrapped up, sorry about that, is a picture book author, nonfiction writer, well-known youth writer here in Boston. Well, I was very excited that you wrote
it. Claim it, Tammy.
I'll take it. Okay, yes, I am well-known.
Best known for her series, Definitely Daphne. Her most recent novel, Becoming Beatrice, is a very necessary portrayal of a young Afro-Latina from Puerto Rico living in New Jersey who has to make her own path. And so now, what I want to do is give folks a chance to give the audience an experience of the book and these folks' best laid plans. Would you like to go ahead?
Sure, yeah. My story, as was briefly recapped, is about a sophomore in high school named Wyatt. And Wyatt wants nothing more than to have a better relationship with his older brother, Brett, who is the senior captain, quarterback of the football team, whereas Wyatt is kind of an overweight lineman who has never really felt that sort of connection with his brother that he's hoping for. So his best laid plan is pretty simple from the outset, is to make varsity football, become a teammate of Brett's, and hopefully establish a connection with him before Brett goes off to college. But things go awry. He makes the team, but when Brett, his brother, suffers a terrible concussion and only Wyatt knows about it, Wyatt is left with the decision of whether to keep that secret and keep that promise to his brother or tell the truth for the physical safety of his own brother. So thinking about this theme of best laid plans, it got me thinking about how it's so interesting with adolescents especially that it's a time in your life when you're really actually starting to make your own plans rather than just following what you've been told throughout childhood. Your plans are often from your parents, frankly, but once you start reaching adolescence, you start having some more autonomy over what your own plans are. But I think what the real challenge with that is, And I think all these novels touch on this in some degree, is that coming of age isn't learning that like there's a roadmap that you have to follow, or if there's a wrong turn, you have to find your way back. It's actually that there is no roadmap, and that's like a really hard thing to reconcile. And underneath all that, understanding hopefully by the end of a journey that it's relying on yourself. And staying true to who you are is the only foundation you can really count on because the roadmap often is not even there.
All right. So my name is Thanh Ha. I write about refugees, particularly Vietnamese refugees. So Inside Out and Back Again is about myself. And with Butterfly Yellow, I jumped into the YA world because we're now dealing with an 18-year-old. If I left Vietnam in 1975 under relatively safe circumstances, I was on a Navy ship, then Hung is what's called among the second wave. She is leaving Vietnam on a rickety fishing boat. So it's a traumatic story. She's going to suffer traumatic trauma while she gets to Texas. And she has one goal, that is to find her little brother. They got separated at the end of the war. It's 6 years later. She's determined to find him. So when it comes to best laid plans, hers have been thrown up into the air since day one. First, Vietnam wasn't supposed to get turned over to the communists. She wasn't supposed to leave the country. And then when she finally gets to Texas, she has this dream of embracing her brother, and he rejects her. So then the rest of the novel is about how does she get him back. And because it's such a traumatic story, I had to bring humor in. There's no way I could sit still for 5 years and write this without bringing humor in. And so I had her going across dusty, flat, brown, panhandle Texas. And on the way, she meets a red-haired American cowboy wannabe. He's not even a real cowboy. He gets roped into this adventure, and together they will go find her brother. So he's there to bring in the humor, because without it, I'm not sure if I could get through writing it, much less you reading it. And then when her trauma is revealed, it's very, you know, she's thinking it inside her head as the cowboy is just talking. So the challenge was intermixing humor with trauma, and then have it come out to be a read where it feels like I'm blowing you a kiss. So that just took forever.
So I'm Nandini Bajpai, and I grew up in India, but I've lived here for over 20 years in the Boston area. And my pet peeve when I was growing up was I couldn't find any books in which there were Indian girls like me that were not sort of really heavy and, you know, really sort of exhausting to read. And I just wanted, you know, happy comfort reads. And so that's what I write. I write sort of upbeat, joyful, silly, funny, romantic, young adult. And I think there is a need for that sort of stuff as well. So this is my first book to be published in the US. It's about Simran Sangha, who's a 15-year-old girl in New Jersey who comes from a Punjabi-American family. And Simi's mother, her aunt, her grandmother, and all the women from generations before in her family have been matchmakers. And even in New Jersey, her mother and her aunt have a matchmaking service, and they put together, you know, young people in their community who are looking for a match. So in the new generation of kids in their family, nobody has wanted to go into that business, and it is a family business, so they're kind of disappointed. But Simi has the knack. She has a knack she inherited from, you know, the women in her family to put together people who click. So once they realize that, they're like, well, you have to do this. And she's like, no, I love art. Simi really likes art. So she is hell-bent on being an artist. And so there's a little bit of, you know, sort of humorous and serious, you know, tension between her mom and her aunt and her grandmother and her, because they want to follow a path. She is not even sure, to be honest, if matchmaking should be a thing in America, you know, why, for her generation. But what she does is she takes their techniques and their wisdom, whatever they've learned, and tries to put it into a dating app for her high school. And that dating app called Matched goes viral. And then mayhem ensues because, you know, their techniques are slightly different than just swiping right and left based on what somebody looks like. So it kind of creates chaos, and Simi does find somebody she likes as well. So it's that is the book.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay, so Becoming Beatrice is a companion to my first novel, Like Vanessa. To tell you about Becoming Beatrice, I got to tell you a little bit about Like Vanessa. Like Vanessa is an upper middle grade, early YA. It's about a girl named Vanessa Martin who. She sees the very first woman of color win Miss America in 1983. This woman's name was Vanessa Williams. So when she sees that, she's thinking, oh my gosh, like maybe I can do something like this. Her school just so happens that they're going to have their own contest at school. My character, Vanessa, has an incredible voice, but she's very, very shy. she decides to do this contest at the urging of her best friend and her family. But there's a girl in the contest who kind of tells Vanessa, you're not going to win. You're not pretty enough. You're not thin enough. You're just not good enough. The girl who does that, her name is Beatrice. So I felt like Beatrice needed her own story because in like Vanessa, she was such a biatch. but at the teacher in me and the human in me knows that bullies aren't born that way. Something happened to them to make them that way. And there's always a chance to redeem yourself. So becoming Beatrice, it tells the story of an Afro-Latina from Puerto Rico who comes to New Jersey, and the way that her and her family make it, her brother runs a gang. Her brother dies as a result of his gang involvement, and upon his death, she feels the need to keep his legacy, if that's what you would call it, to keep his legacy going by running the gang. But that's not what she really wants. Best laid plans, right? She doesn't want to do that. She really, really wants to dance. So she has to navigate life in a gang and her real passion, which is the dance floor.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
You guys can also talk to these folks more downstairs. They'll be at the author table with Frugal Books, signing books, and chatting it up with you all after the session. So make sure you do that if you want to get a copy of these books. I just wanted to throw a question to you guys, if I could, and then we're going to have the audience also ask you questions as well. Just one thing I was struck by was reading these. I read them all together.
God bless you. In one night.
They were all in my head as I was reading the next one, And I was very struck by I don't know how contextual each character was, how contextual their problem was, how contextual their issues were. And that made it feel like it was they were all happening today, even though some of them are 70s, 80s. Some of them are present day. So I guess I wanted to hear about, like, how did you guys come up with these characters, these stories? And then were there any particular challenges in bringing out some of these stories, given some of the issues that you touch? Poverty, racism, just a lack of cultural knowledge, the refugee crisis that we're facing today. If you guys want to maybe kind of just talk about that process.
That can happen. So apparently, because Becoming Beatrice is set in 1984, that's historical fiction.
It
which is.
Is
absolutely ridiculous. The 80s were just yesterday. But the problems that are featured in this book, we still go through this today. Racism, homophobia, colorism, these are all very, very prominent problems in especially communities of color. Especially where I come from. I was born in Newark, New Jersey, and I clearly remember a lot of these problems happening. A lot of what Beatrice goes through, the fact that she's in a gang, the fact that her brother ran a gang, I kind of dealt with that in my own family, and I don't say that proudly. FYI, I'm not in a gang, just saying. Have no plans. But I do have a couple of family members who, back then, they felt that that was their only way out, or the only way to succeed. I'll say this, though. I'm lucky that they haven't read this book, because I put a little bit too much of them in there. But I think it's important for people to know that. And whether it's being in a gang or being a refugee, a problem is a problem. And I think readers need to know that there are other options besides, you know, being in a gang. There's a way out there. You have choices to make something of your life. So it wasn't that hard, but I think it was very necessary.
Okay, oh, great. I agree, Tammy. My book is set in 1981, so it's also historical fiction. And, you know, when I was writing this, I've been thinking about Hung for a very long time because I was a journalist at the Orange County Register, where more Vietnamese live outside of Vietnam than anywhere else. It's where you go for Vietnamese food, by the way. And so I'm thinking I'm writing historical fiction. The refugee crisis has calmed down. I've been thinking about this for 30 years, apparently. And when I was a journalist, it was too intimate a story to put to a real face and then splash her all over the front page. I knew I would have to go towards the fiction end. I just didn't know how long it would take me. And so now that Hung is out in the world, you know, any minute, in any second, you can say that there is somebody floating somewhere in the seas, probably in the Mediterranean, trying to get to probably Italy. That's what's happening, the trajectory of the refugee crisis. And Italy is saying, no, you can't land here. So they're pushing them back out to sea. So all this is constantly going on. And of course, it touches on what's happening at the American borders. So historical fiction is funny. It has a way of coming right in and just biting you. So in that sense, it's timely.
So with my books, I always try to start with the lived experience that, you know, what I've lived through or what people close to me have lived through. My husband grew up here. He came over here as a two-year-old. I grew up in India, and we had very different experiences of the U.S. And people in my community, they're at all different levels of, you know, assimilation and how much they've held on to their cultural heritage and how much they've let go. And, you know, it's really interesting to explore between the first and second generation of immigrants, what they've held on to. And this is not the same for everyone. So you try and be, you know, you try and recognize that, and you try and write about one particular person, but also, you know, the reality of all the other people in their world. And that's what I try and do. That's always the context for me. I think it's far more authentic and believable if you're drawing from your own experience and those of people close to you.
I agree, and I think that's definitely true of my novel. Football was and is a big part of my life, something I played from a young age and played seriously in high school and then into college. And what I find so gripping about fiction is that is the fiction that looks at two opposing ideas and holds them up at the exact same time and understands that there's nuances between them. And for me personally, that's always been sort of my relationship with football. It's a sport that I deeply love and appreciate, and a lot of the qualities of me as an adult that I value came from my experience in football. But on the other hand, I recognize there's some serious issues with the sport, not just with concussions, but with the culture surrounding it. And for instance, I never suffered a big concussion, but I had a very serious knee injury that has affected even my adult life today. And it's interesting to me how people, and my dad is this way too, because he played football, when these injuries come, and the way we killed time to recover and what made us feel better is watching football. And that's just such an interesting thing to me. So my novel is kind of like exploring. It's kind of a love letter to the game, but it's also kind of a breakup letter at the same time. And I think I try to use Wyatt as kind of the conduit of that. Because he is someone who I hope the reader can see why it grow through the camaraderie and the brotherhood that he gets through football, but also he has to really grapple with some of the challenges with the game, especially with the masculine culture that is pervasive in it in ways that are both good and bad.
Thank you. Am I allowed to ask another question? Cool, because I'm very interested in what you guys have to say. I want to know more about your choice to write for teens, especially for some of you who have not done that before. It kind of has come out already in terms of like your own experience, making sure that people know that they have many options.
I don't know how well other writers plan. They probably do. I kind of sit down and go, okay, this is my story. They have to be 18 in order for the story to work. And I'm thinking, I don't think in terms of marketing and whatever. So then I give it to my editor, and she turns white. And I'm like, why? I just jumped from middle grade to YA. Apparently, it's a very, very big deal. For one thing, they shelf them differently in a bookstore. I didn't know that because I live in a cave. I don't know anything. I just discovered Twitter last month. So I'm way behind on the game. She just shakes her head at me. But so you, sometimes you don't decide, right? Suddenly you're like typing along. Okay, it has to be 18 because they have to get away from our uncle and they have to be able to go on this journey by themselves. If they were younger, he could yank her back and say, I am your guardian. You can't go. So that's why they have to be 18. And then suddenly I'm in this very, very scary world called YA. It's a totally different world.
So I've written middle grade novels. The first book that I ever wrote was middle grade. But I'm just, you know, when I sit down and think and ideas come to me, people have an internal voice that they're really comfortable with, and mine happens to be like 17 years old. I never got over that for some reason. So it's natural to me. And also I find the, you know, just that age is so interesting because you have so many possibilities. You have so many possibilities, you have so much to look forward to, and you're finding yourself. So it's that whole threshold between childhood and adulthood experience that can go in so many directions. And I just really enjoy writing for that gender.
That's great.
I write for teens because when I was a teenager, I didn't read these type of diverse books growing up. And I know it's like said a lot, but it's true. Like I didn't really see myself in the books that I read as a teenager. I read a lot of Sweet Valley High and V.C. Andrews, which was highly inappropriate at the time. But again, like these were like perfect girls with convertibles riding off into the sunset. I was born in Newark. We didn't have all of that. So it didn't dawn on me that diverse books existed back then, mainly because of access and exposure. When I became a teacher, I noticed that, wow, there's some like really good books that I would have killed for as a child. I would have loved to read these fabulous books by like Meg Medina and Kwame Alexander. Like, where were these when I was growing up? And that's when I kind of revisited my childhood dream of becoming an author. That's when I find it took me becoming almost 40 years old to realize that I could like fulfill this dream. So, you know, selfishly, I write for teenage me, but I think I'm also writing for other, not just kids of color, all kids.
Yeah.
They need to see that there's life outside of a white picket fence, and you know, that literature comes in all beautiful colors. So that's why I write. And I'll say this, I write YA, and some of the things that I put in my books can be like emotionally draining. I do infuse humor because that's important, but when I'm done, I gotta go back to picture books. I write picture books too, and for me, that's just like a release to kind of like get the heavy stuff off my plate and let me do something light and fun.
For me, it's a pretty natural progression from my daily life where I'm a high school English teacher, so I'm immersed in high school drama at all times. And what I love so much about my students, one of whom is here actually, and I'm very excited about that. What I love so much about my students is they're so smart, and I think teenagers are so, in a way, they're actually more wise than adults because their emotions are so close to the surface. They're so real, but they can access it in a way that I think is harder for adults, and that's something I really admire. They can be incredibly brilliant and smart one moment and totally foolish the next, and they can be hilarious one moment and then and really feel pain in the next, and that all comes together for some really compelling storytelling and exploration of really the human condition. So it's really it's just an age so ripe with emotion that I'm really drawn to that.
So there's a lot of room for creativity in this kind of writing. And also, there's the little teenager that's still inside.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. I think mine is 8. My little person is 8. So.
One last question before I throw it out to the audience. Is that okay?
Okay, cool.
I'm looking at you for time. I'm sorry to keep looking at you. Just one last question for the young adults in the room who want to write. If you could just talk about the publishing process, and not like first you do this, and second you do this, but some of the maybe challenges that you've had, especially with stories that I would say are sort of on the margin. You know, you've got Wyatt is a poor young white man from the Cape. We don't often hear stories like that. Refugees, Desi Americans, people growing up in New Jersey, and around gang activity. We don't get to hear a lot of like variety around those kind of stories. So I'm wondering if that caused any issues for you. If there are other challenges, I think people who want to write would like to know, like, how do you overcome them?
I have something. For the YA people in the room who want to write YA, get used to the word no. You're going to hear it a lot. Grow a thick skin. This business is not for, you know, wimps. You got to be tough. You got to be strong. And persevere. Make a schedule for yourself, because on the days when you don't want to write, you just got to get your butt in the chair and do it. And yeah, that's really it. Because I talk about this a lot. Like, I go to schools and I talk to schools, students at schools, about the power of no and the beauty of yes. There are many times where that no can be a blessing, where you write a story and you send it to a publisher and they reject it. That's your opportunity to make it better. And the more you do that, the harder you work, guaranteed your yes will come. It might take some time. Some people, some authors, I look at them and I'm like, wow, they just, you know, blew up overnight. But you don't know their story. You don't know their struggle. Like, every author's journey is different. And just put your blinders on. Don't worry about what other authors are doing. You can still clap for them and you can still cheer for them, but your journey is your own. And just know that you're going to hear no a few times, probably a lot. But then at some point, the yeses will start to come.
I totally agree. Get used to the word no. There's so much rejection. But, you know, while you're hearing the no's and the rejection, you have to keep learning. And one thing I'd like to say is that you have to read a lot. Like, read yeah. as much as you can, because the way you learn to write is having read and understanding craft. And then when you first start writing, when I first started writing, I didn't have a MFA. I didn't, you know, study creative writing. I learned to write by writing, by reading and then by writing. Because if you have an ear and you like reading good fiction, you can tell when you're not doing it right. And it's frustrating, but you get better as you try, just by doing. And then revision is key. The first thing you ever write is never going to be perfect. You have to get feedback from critique partners, from other people who you trust, and revise and make things better. So reading, writing, and revising on repeat is how you get better at craft. And then, of course, you have to keep putting the story out there. You have to keep, you know, submitting it, getting in front of people. If it's just sitting in a drawer somewhere, it's not going to get published. You have to get it out there. And things are getting better in publishing, I feel. This is my first book to be published in the U.S., but I've published 3 books in India with Scholastic India and Rupa, which is a huge publisher there. Because when I first got those books out, the world wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody wanted to publish a historical set in 12th century India. They're like, who is even going to read that? Well, you know, these are invisible parts of history that maybe people should read. So the world is changing, and you have to have that faith and persevere.
You know, when it comes to, first you need an agent. Agents are business people. Mm-hmm. If they see a good story, trust me, they will jump on it. So your first job is to write the manuscript. And helping along the way would be workshops. I would take workshops. They're everywhere. You don't even have to physically show up. You can just take one online. And then they have these lovely people, well, maybe not so lovely after a while, but at first they are called critics, and they will take your writing seriously and do line edits, line by line, and give you feedback. It is within your power to reject it or not, but it is very important to just not write in a bubble, which I did, so don't do what I did. Write outside of your bubble and see if people even understand what you're trying to say. and see if you can withstand the kind of criticism that's going to come your way. Because an editor is going to do the same thing, probably 100-fold what you're getting in this class. So it's just good practice. And all along the way, I don't care what prizes you've won, I don't care how many books you have published, your manuscript is still brand new. When you send it out to your editor, it's still going to get the same kind of notes, and it'll still come back to you. And give yourself permission to write poorly. That's how you get better. Your first few sentences are just going to suck. And it's okay.
They always do.
Yeah, I would say that the biggest obstacle for anyone, mm-hmm. young or old, and I think we probably all deal with this ourselves now, is the biggest obstacle is self-doubt. And you just have to... I talk to a lot of students who are interested in writing and want to tell stories, and they're like, I want to be a writer, but I feel like I don't have an interesting story in me, or the story I want to tell has already been told in a better way or a more unique perspective. But I really don't think that's true. I really think everyone has a story or many stories within them to share, and it's a matter of carefully digging and finding that story and presenting it in a way that's compelling. And the other sort of technical side thing I would mention, and again, this is, I'm not just saying this because I have a student in the room, but grammar is important. She's one of my better ones, but it's grammar. I think a lot of times people look at creative writing as like, oh, this is this great venue for me to break the rules and really be creative. But in order to do that, you first actually have to have a really good sense of how to craft a clear sentence. Clarity is everything, and grammar will help you get there. So learn grammar, learn how to structure clauses, and learn your parts of speech, and see how those all fit together, and then you can start breaking the rules. Because until you really have a good sense of grammar, it is hard to tell your story in a clear and powerful way.
Yay for grammar. I have not sat next to a teacher who preached grammar in so long. I go on home visits where they tell me, we don't teach parts of speech anymore. And I'm like, well, how do you put a sentence together? You know what they say? By feel. I'm like, what?
I think three things we forgot. Eat, hydrate, and shower. Because days can go by, and if you're too into it, you might forget. So, yeah. And get up and walk, too, because, like, writing is such a sedentary process.
Get
you don't want early-onset arthritis.
Yeah. Get a dog. It forces you to go outside
I want
and
a dog.
Walk.
I got to work on
and
that.
Look at the sun and look at the leaves falling down. You interact with nature. You can know what season it is. Yeah. You know, it's good for you. So I have three dogs.
I've had, at times, you know, I have fosters, so mm-hmm. at times,
it's very good for you.
And then to add on to that, I would really say just don't be on your phone so much. You have to observe the world. Like mm-hmm. when you're sitting on a train, it's so tempting just to pull up your phone. Like just look around. Like there, you can your imagination sparks. You can start. You see things and you notice little nuances of humanity that you would never have noticed before.
That's what stories are.
Yeah, exactly.
People watching.
Yeah.
I call that stalking.
Yeah.
That's where you get your real stories.
All right, thank you so much, you guys. I'm going to open it up to the audience, and I want to encourage folks on the younger end to get their questions out or thoughts out that they want to throw up to the authors up here. I want to encourage those folks to raise their hand first and encourage other folks to kind of sit back and let those folks raise their hand first. So anything you'd like to ask the authors about their books or about their writing process, about some of the issues raised in their books. It's all up for grabs. So just raise your hand if you'd like to talk to us.
So I've read Inside Out and Back Again. I was wondering, why did you choose to write in that style?
Oh, you have just asked the question that is the number one question everywhere I go. It is because we are in present tense with Ha, right? What language is she thinking in when the story opens? She's in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So she's thinking in Vietnamese. For some reason, in my head, it's because I have a poet, a house poet for a mom. When I speak Vietnamese or hear Vietnamese, it sounds like a poem because it's just a melodic, poetic language. So when I first tried this story for 15 years, I was typing in long sentences, and it was never authentic. It never rang true. And then one day, you know how these things happen to you? Gazam! I came up with this, and I thought I invented these. I did not. So it's supposed to feel like you're reading Vietnamese.
So a couple of you mentioned including humor in your story, and so I was just wondering, when you were writing it, is that humor something that came naturally, or did you have to finish, let's say, the first draft, the second draft, go back and actually add humor in on purpose?
So my husband, he missed his calling. He could have been a comedian. We could be rich right now, but he wanted to be an engineer.
It's not too late.
My husband is the funniest person that I know. So he gets mad at me because I do steal his lines. I'm like, you're my husband. I don't have to pay you for this. I'm going to stick this in my book. I venture to say that I kind of weave it in there, like, as I'm writing, you know, from the get-go.
Yeah, it's something that I would say is a combination for me. The voice of the character, I think if you really understand the character well, that humor will actually start to just come out naturally. But I also do try to, especially on second and third drafts, when I look at the flow of the tone, and especially if things are dark for a long time, I do try to intentionally say, okay, this, I think the reader, you have to think a lot through the eyes of the reader. This, they need maybe some levity or a break here. So I actually might go back and try to inject some humor. And there is a craft to writing a good joke, too. And I think even like the most talented comedians today would tell you that it's not, they don't just get out there and spew it. They really work and hone their jokes over years sometimes. And sometimes it's a matter of like one or two words that like changing their location or adding something that can suddenly ignite a joke and make it funny. So I would say that it does take a certain amount of patience and finesse, but it's worth it.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I end up having to take humor out. There's too much in there in the first draft sometimes. I think, you know, characters who are able to laugh at themselves are just more likable, and, you know, it's just more fun to write them. So that's what ends up happening with me. But I don't deliberately craft jokes. It just naturally comes with the voice.
Well, you know, we read for entertainment. I mean, we read for many reasons, but one of them is to be entertained. You just don't want to cry throughout the book. I mean, you can cry a little bit, but how fun would it be to just cry for 360 pages, right? And how fun would that be to write? So when I start to conceive of an idea, automatically I'm already thinking, okay, how am I going to work humor into this? And it's purely for self-preservation. I am not going to sit there for 5 years and cry. I got to have some other moments.
Is it okay if I add to that question and ask any one of you to pick something out, like one of your funniest? Or
why don't we each pick one out?
Oh, no? God. Wait, let her finish the question first. I'll decide if I want to be a part of this.
No, just something that helps to demonstrate what this person was asking about, the leaving in the humor. Or even just your favorite joke that you crafted in the book.
Yeah,
you
I'm out. You guys got this.
You all were very funny.
Well, I think the beginning of my story starts with, it's not a joke per se, but it's just Simi laughing at herself and her family. So, you know, it starts by saying, matching furniture is like matching couples. There must be balance, harmony, and excitement between the sofa and the side table, the lampshade and the rug. Just as there's balance, harmony, and excitement between two people who are perfect for each other. Sound ridiculous? Welcome to my world, where this isn't a bit of feng shui or vastu, it's actually the way my family sees parents and people. So it starts with, you know, having a little bit of a laugh at the expense of the whole family.
I would say, I spent the longest time on my first sentence, or one of my first sentences, and that was mostly because I really wanted to get down the voice of my character. He's someone who employs a lot of self-deprecating humor. So he's talking kind of about how he's kind of an oversized guy, and sometimes that's hard for him. And he says, you know, he wishes he was kind of bigger and stronger, that his weight was more in a kind of the typically masculine football strong guy way. And he talks about, he says, I'm sure girls would still laugh when I accidentally broke a pencil in my big clumsy paws, but it would be a flirty laugh, like a giggle, and they'd say, "Oh, your giant hands are so strong." And I'd reply, "Well, you know what they say about guys with big hands." And they'd grin and be like, "What do they say about guys with big hands?" And I'd be like, "Greater risk for cancer." Or something or something equally stupid, because I'm so awkward around girls, I blow it even in my fantasies. So that was kind of the line that was just on my computer for a long time, because I was like, I finally felt like I nailed his voice in that line. And I tried to allow that to guide me when I got stuck at other points.
You can if you want to. You don't. I white flagged out. Here's the thing. Here's a pro tip. These novels, so even though this published on September 17th, I wrote this like 3 years ago. So I don't know what pages, like you guys are good. I don't know what page, but it's in there. I promise.
We can throw it back up to the audience.
Oh, we have one in the front. So why do you guys think writing is so important and so interesting?
It's like what Tammy said, when I was growing up, there were no books about, kids like me when I was younger. And it's so important. When I had my own children, there were still no books about Indian kids, So you have to kind of put yourself out of your comfort zone and actually, do the work to make those stories happen. They're just somebody else is not going to come and do it. Everybody has to take charge and say, okay, I can do this. I have the skills. I think it was important enough to me to try and, put in the work to make it happen.
Why is it important? Okay, go ahead.
No, go.
I was thinking, well, it's because it's the closest I've come to being a superhero.
Nice.
Because I get to fly inside of people's minds and, untangle all their little secrets they won't even tell themselves. Because Hung, my character, goes through such trauma that she's locked it so deep inside her mind. And I, as a writer, get to bring it out slowly in a way that's compassionate, in a way that's believable. And then I get to work with humor. And for a second, it doesn't work all the time, but once in a while you feel like, I got this, right? And it's a wonderful feeling that you can actually, and everything you've ever seen, smell, touch, it all goes into your work anyway. So then you do feel like you're extra alive, because every sense, every sensory experience gets used somehow.
So I'm a mom. I have a son. His name is Christopher. He's 9 years old. And his father, my husband, his family is from Haiti. And growing up, I definitely did not read any stories that featured Haitian characters or Haitian, anything about Haiti. In fact, as I grew up, I found that a lot of the way Haiti is portrayed in our media, it's not good. So as his mom, and because I love to write, I felt like it was my duty to also tell those stories so that he can navigate through this world with his chin up and know that, he comes from an island of perseverance and pride. I have a picture book that's publishing in December. It's called Freedom Soup. And it's all about this delicious soup that Haitians all over the world eat on New Year's Day. And there's a story behind that. And we do this every year in my family. We have this soup, but I don't want my son just eating the soup. I want him to know why he's eating the soup. And so that's why I write. I write for him so that he knows how important he is and that he matters. And I write so that other people can see that too.
Yeah, what I love so much about reading and writing is that it's, on the one hand, it's the most isolating thing you can possibly do. You are alone at the keyboard, or you are alone in your bed reading the book. But ironically, somehow, those really isolating things create this really intimate connection, either sort of through the author and the reader, or through the protagonist and the reader, which I guess in a way is the same thing. But really, life is just, aren't we all here essentially to not be to fight loneliness. And reading and writing, I think, is the most intimate form of connection between people. And it just it's so invigorating that way.
It's also just fun, you know, mm-hmm. making stuff up, you know, just daydreaming and creating stories out of nothing. It's really fun. So there's that on a good day.
So my question is, do you believe that representation in young adult literature has gotten better, or has it, do we still need to add more representation?
I think the notch moved up 1%. What was it, 5% of stories told were by, you know, stories that featured kids of color were told by people of color. I think it's 6% now.
Oh, I don't know the statistics.
Yeah, so the, I think it's CCBC. My editor is in the audience. I already peeped you out, Carter. So don't be judging me if I'm saying the acronym wrong. But I think it's the CCBC. They compile statistics like every year, and they have this awesome graphic that tells the percentages among groups, like which group, you know, has the most representation. So obviously a lot of children's picture books, honestly, like animals get more love than people of color. It's kind of ridiculous and funny at the same time. I think the needle has moved a hair. It's nice that it's getting better, but I think we have a lot more work to do.
And she's just talking about the books in this country. I grew up in India, and we didn't have any books in India about Indian kids. All of our children's books that I grew up reading were imports from...
The UK?
Yeah, from the
really?
UK.
Really?
And America. There were no books in... There were some Amar Chitrakathas, which are, you know, comic books, but they were all mythology. Because, you know, their publishing wasn't there yet. It was a developing country. It wasn't one of the industries that was strong enough. So everything was imports. We grew up reading Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and Enid Blyton and all of this stuff. So there is so much more room. And there's so many people in Asia whose stories have not been told as a percentage of the global population, you know? So I think there's a long way to go.
You want to write?
Join us.
Resist.
I will tell you that every book festival I've been to in the last year, that question has come up, and I have seen a difference in the panelists that I'm with and the questions that have been asked. So it seems like it's changing just from sheer observation. And so, yeah, I think it is. And I think you would be very welcomed. Come on over.
Yeah.
And I think of all the genres, it seems like YA is a really good fertile ground for that. It's funny, I don't consider myself that old, but when I was a teenager, YA like wasn't a genre. Like if you went to a bookstore and said, I want YA, they'd be like, what is that? And then you say, I'd want a story about a teenager, and they'd be like, here's Catcher in the Rye, and like Holden Caulfield, however you feel about him, doesn't get much more white male than Holden. But that was kind of like what you had to grab onto, and so it is, I think YA is a really good space for different voices.
Hooray!
And the flyers too.
We gotta give the old people a chance too, right? So my question is, I mean, we need to build communities of readers. That's for sure. And young adults, oftentimes, I was an elementary school librarian where the kids were so enthusiastic about reading, and then they got to middle school and high school, they got bogged down in their subject work. They didn't read a lot for pleasure. If the books were out there, I don't even think they're getting in their hands sometimes. And I wondered, you just mentioned Catcher in the Rye, and in your English class, do you get to expose the kids to some of this type of young adult novel, or are you still kind of constrained? You know, like my son came home with a Scarlet Letter when he was a junior in high school. I thought, why are they still doing this? Why don't they get the kids to read?
It's so funny that you mentioned that. This is kind of behind the scenes, but like we're going through a curricular review right now of the English program at my school, and literally Scarlet Letter came up just the other day in our meeting because it's taught to some of our juniors, and we had this interesting discussion around it being like, do they get something out of the Scarlet Letter? Yes, they do. Mostly because the teachers are really great. But like, do they enjoy reading it, or actually, do they dread reading it? And that led to the discussion of like, well, what is the ultimate goal here in choosing our literature? And I really do think, especially in today's age, as teachers in schools and librarians, it's so important that we cultivate the love of reading. And there's enough out there that is both considered to be a very high level of writing, but also entertaining as something that the kids want to go towards. So I think there's a lot of pressure in schools to feel like they need to cover the masterpieces, and that if you don't cover these novels, then they're going to go on to college, and people are going to be talking about the Scarlet Letter, and then they're going to be alone and never date anyone, never get married, and it'll be horrible. But the other problem with that is something we were just talking about, is that masterpieces are often from the 19th century and things, and that, again, it's white male writers, and they are masterpieces and they should be read, but you can see how they get funneled and spoon-fed to students. So I think schools are trying, though, to look at this more broadly now. So YA is becoming more accepted as a actual literary work rather than just kind of fluff to read on the side.
Can I just ask a follow-up question to that really fast? Do you actually assign contemporary YA? Are there any that have reached the curriculum?
There is a senior elective that teaches Harry Potter and alongside of some other fantasy novels, so I would say it's up there. That might be the closest we get.
I just think young people should read for enjoyment, yeah. And not just for, you know, improving their literary skills for enjoyment, for fun.
Well, my son's in sixth grade, and they don't actually have assignments yet. It's the beginning of the year. They don't have books assigned. They just have to read half an hour a night. Yeah. And my son is really into these spy school books, and so he eats them. He reads one, like, every couple of days.
This is where the librarians come in.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They will recognize. They're the superheroes.
No. Yeah. And I'm so sorry, audience.
Sorry.
No, I was just saying, librarians are superheroes. They match, you know, you're one. So, you know, they match kids up with books, and they make it happen, that magic.
They do read. When I go to book festivals, I'm always I was just at the teen book festival in Texas. There were mass numbers of teenagers lining up to buy books that they were not assigned in school. And they were excited to read them. So, yeah, they're reading. You just, maybe they hide it because it's not. I don't know.
Does anyone have any other last comments that they wanted to throw in there?
Yeah, if you're looking for, you know, to broaden his reading shelf, look into Project Lit, and we need diverse books. But if he's devouring books, I say just let him go.
Okay. Well, that is the end of our panel discussion. Thank you so much. Can everybody please clap for these wonderful authors?
Thank you.
If you want to buy their books, they are downstairs at the Frugal Books table. And these folks will be signing those books as well.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Guys, you want to take a quick selfie?